You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Good morning. Well, if I haven't met you before, my name's Rachel, and I'm one of the pastors here at Life in Deep Ellum. And we're going to be continuing our series this morning on the good life, and we're about 3 weeks in. So we have talked about so far how to navigate transitions and expectations, and today we're going to talk a little bit about identity. So you guys ready for that? The fun thing about writing a sermon about identity is I don't know anyone who has not struggled at some level with the question of who am I? Who was I created to be? And so we're going to dig into that a little bit today. And I really, as we talk through this, I want you to sit with that question for yourself of who am I? And if you ever have been asked that question with the expectation that you will actually answer it, you realize it's a very difficult question to answer if you don't answer it in terms of what you do. And so that's the question we're going to look at today is who are you? Not what you do, but who are you? And perhaps the most important question is the second one of who does God say that you are? Who does God say that you are? So those are the two questions I kind of want us to really wrestle through. And in order to do that, you may want to have a Bible because we don't put scripture verses up on the screens. So if you don't have a Bible with you this morning or an electronic format that you're comfortable with, if you'll raise your hand, one of our ushers will bring one to you. And if you want to get a jump on where we're going today, you can go ahead and turn to Exodus 2. When I was in college, the university that I attended, they administered to all of their students the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis. And you had to take it whenever you came into the school, and then they would set up a meeting with you and one of the counselors, and you would get to go, and they would tell you all about yourself. And prior to that, I had never really done a lot of personality tests, so I was kind of excited. You know, when my time came and I got to sit at the table across from the counselor, I'd never done counseling before, so it was this whole new exciting experience, and I sit down so eager to learn about myself. And the counselor just kind of smiles at me, and she said, Rachel, we couldn't read your results. Because the test has the scoring mechanism in it that scores for stress. And your score came back in a way that we can't read it. She said, basically, you're the type of person who's good at taking tests, and so what you gave us were the right answers, not the authentic answers. Her exact verbiage was, your test read like a strong, well-adjusted 80-year-old woman had taken the test. I was 17. So they gave me the option to take it again and the advice that I should just relax, go with my gut, whatever my first instinct was on the test, you know, put that in. And so I tried really hard to do that, to not overthink it. I mean, so, you know, I came in again with high hopes, sat down across from the counselor, and she just smiled at me, and she said, your stress score is still too high to read, in an entirely different way this time. And so that's when I gave up. And I decided that I hated personality tests and developed a strong disdain for them that is still active to this day, as well as a strong desire for no one to tell me who I am, which I think I may have already had. But it was an interesting experience. I went in so excited, and you know, there was this part of me when she told me that my test read like a strong, well-adjusted 80-year-old woman that just wanted that to be true of me. And for me to be the exception to all reality and just be that awesome as a 17-year-old, which looking back in retrospect, I know was not the case. But, you know, whenever we start thinking about identity, that 80-year-old woman may be in me, but I haven't lived the life yet to get to enjoy that fullness of who I am. You know, our personality, it comes to us as a gift. It comes to us from a gift from God, and we will spend the rest of our life unwrapping that gift, discovering who God created us to be, understanding what that looks like in all of the different circumstances and situations and times that he'll put us into. I used to think that personality was this thing that if you could just figure out who you were, then you were set. And it was like done, and then you just had to figure out what to do with who you are. And I've grown to a place of understanding it doesn't really work that way. It's just this slow, gradual uncovering over time of who God created you to be. And so I want to talk a little bit more about this idea that identity isn't something that we make up for ourselves. It's not something that we make up for ourselves. It's a gift. And this is one of those things I think we have to get at the beginning when we're talking about identity. Several weeks ago, as we started the series, I talked about an idea of how second natures are developed in us. That we, you know, some people will talk about, oh, that was just second nature. Well, second nature means that it's not first nature. It means that it's something that you learned. That it was something that was developed in you over time. It's a second nature. It's something that was not innate to you, but you learned how to do it. And my experience is that whenever it comes to our identity, learning to receive it as a gift from God is a second nature kind of thing. It is not natural for us most of the time to just receive who we are from God. There is generally this lots of striving that goes into it rather than being able to just accept it as a gift that comes from the Lord. But I think that if we can begin to think about our identity not as something that we earn or we deserve, but receive it as a gift, it begins to change a lot of things. And whenever you start to think about identity as a gift and in terms of a gift, I think the best gifts have this element of mutuality to them. And I don't think I ever thought about my relationship with God and how he interacts with us in terms of mutuality until a friend gave me this assignment. She told me, she said, Rachel, I want you to list all the ways that God trusts you. And I was like, wait. She's like, I know you trust God, but sometimes I don't think you realize he trusts you. And so she started to teach me there's this mutuality in our relationship with God, and that's true also of our identity. I think as a child, whenever I was growing up, I was so afraid that God was going to give me an identity that I hated. That it was like I grew up in this kind of faith background that in order to really be a spiritual person, it was like you had to give up and sacrifice the things that you most wanted out of life in order to really love Jesus. Like, that was how you proved it. And so I lived in this fear of, like, God making me into something that I was ultimately going to kind of hate to be. And so I went to school first to be a missionary, which we have missionaries in the house, and I'm so grateful for you, but for me, that was like the worst thing I can imagine doing, but I was going to do it because I loved Jesus, and that's what loving Jesus meant, doing what you hated most. But I want us as a community to begin to wrestle with and grapple with this idea that your identity comes to you as a gift. And in order to do that, we have to learn how to receive from God, to receive from him, not to earn it, not to deserve it, not to strive really hard to become it, but to receive it as a gift. And in my experience, one of the best ways we can begin to do this is to practice receiving, but through gratitude. When I was going through the first spiritual exercises with my spiritual director, she gave me this assignment to develop my own, it's a dossier. So I was given the assignment of looking at all of the things in my life that I had no choice on that made me who I was. So she was like, write everything down that has made you who you are that you had no choice in. So my family of origin, where I was born, the country I was born into, the language that I speak, the values that my family held, the schools that I went to as a child, and the list just went on and on and on. And then after I had written out all that, the task was to find a way to be grateful for it. To be grateful that all of these things had come together to make me the person that I am today. And to see God's hand in it before I even had a choice in any of those things. That already he was at work creating me, making me into who he ultimately wanted me to be. So turn with me to Exodus 2. And I want you to keep that in mind as we begin to read. If you grew up in church, you're probably familiar with the life of Moses. But if you didn't, suffice it to say that Moses was the person that God tasked with bringing the children out of slavery in Egypt And that was what he ended up doing. But his identity and his life were very complicated. And Exodus 2 provides us with a short background of the first 40 years of Moses' life. And the gist of it is, he was born into slavery in Egypt, and at the time of his birth, there was an edict that all of the males who were born were to be immediately killed. And Moses' mom, she hid him for 3 months until she just couldn't hide him anymore. And then she made this basket, and she set her son adrift in the Nile River and asked her daughter to watch over him just to see what would happen to this baby. So the river carries him to the place where Pharaoh's daughter would bathe, and she saw this little basket, and she knew it was one of the Hebrew children, and she takes him out of the basket, and she chooses in that moment, without asking anyone, without being concerned about what her father would think about it, she chooses to adopt him. And at that moment, seeing that Pharaoh's daughter was going to take Moses in and allow him to become her son, Marian comes up and she says, "Hey, do you want me to find someone to be the nurse for him?" And Pharaoh's daughter agrees. And then she sends Moses back to his mom. And most historians agree that Moses would have grown up in his parents' home for the first 3 or 4 years of his life. And then it would have been at that point that he would have been brought back to Pharaoh's household and become a part of the household there in Egypt. And so that's what happens in verse 10. It says, "When the child grew older," talking about Moses, his mother took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. So she named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." And what I want you to note as it relates to identity in this particular part of the story is that God will use people and circumstances to show us who we are. God will sometimes use people and circumstances to show us who we are. The book of Exodus, it's widely accepted that Moses is the author of this book. And so when you read it, it's helpful to understand that this is largely autobiographical. Moses is looking back over his life and the story of God fulfilling his covenant with the Hebrew people, and he's picking and choosing these different pieces that really encapsulate that story. And so when we're reading this, we're seeing these little bits of Moses having the benefit of hindsight as he picks and chooses what he shares. And it is clear when Moses is thinking back on this time of his life, he's reflecting on the people and the circumstances that played a significant role in shaping who he would become, of him seeing how God was doing these things to bring him to the point that he would become who he ultimately would be, this deliverer of Israel. And so you see the role of his mother. You see the role of Miriam. You see the role of Pharaoh's daughter. And before Moses had any agency at all, before he could make any decisions for himself, God was at work in people and circumstances creating Moses, drawing Moses. And so Moses reflects back over his life, and he saw this. And what I believe is that when we begin to see ourselves more clearly, we see God's hand at these moments in our life where at the time it was probably really hard for Moses' mother to understand why she was in the circumstance she was in, why her son would be taken from her and raised by this Egyptian princess. But when you look back in retrospect, you begin to see God's hand has been there the entire time. And this is the message of Scripture. If you will, turn with me over to Psalms 139. This is one of my favorite passages in all of Scripture. And I want to start reading in verse 13. And the psalmist says this, "For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." There's this beautiful message of how God attended to us from the very beginning. All of our days were written in his book before one of them came to be. He saw the circumstances of your life, the people that you would encounter, and he began to figure out how to work all of those things together for your good. That to me is amazing. As a seventh grader whose parents were divorcing and my life seemed to be falling apart, I went to that verse in Romans 8 so many times because it says, God works together all things for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And sometimes people go, well, that's just a nice platitude, but man, for me, there was a lot of comfort in believing that God was in the midst of the people and the circumstances and my experiences, that he was there. This week, my dad came to town to visit. He works in the oil industry, so he kind of has a weird schedule. And so we were celebrating my birthday late, and we ended up talking about my brother, Seth. And for those of you who've been around long, you know Seth's story. Seth passed away from leukemia when he was 14 months old. And so he would turn 39 this July. And I was asking my dad about what's grief like now that Seth's been gone for, you know, so many years, because, you know, he talks about what it was like in the early days, and I said, I know it's not like that for you now, but what is it like today? And my dad shared that in all of this time, God has never answered for him the question of why Seth died. He said, I asked that for years and years, and God has never given him an answer. And that used to really torment him. He said, you know, I used to pray and I would tell God, I have nothing else to say to you except why. And until you answer that question, I have nothing else to say to you. And he said he prayed that for years and years. He said, but, you know, the difference for him now is he can accept not knowing why. He said, that's the difference, Rachel. In my grief, I can accept not knowing why. He said, ultimately, I came to believe that the question of why, if he held on to it, would separate him from the God he loves. And so he said that he made the choice to let go of the need to know why, because he wanted to be able to hold on to God. And it wasn't easy for him, and it didn't happen all at once, but he said that holding on to why never brought him peace, but being able to accept Seth's death as a sorrowful mystery did. And we all have these sorrowful mysteries, these things in our life that whenever it comes to our identity, it is so hard to reconcile how God is there in the midst of that, working for our good. And so when it comes to what can we practice to help us grow in our identity, you know, a lot of it centers around trust. But specifically, I would say we have to practice letting go. We have to practice letting go. I would encourage you this week to take time to just kind of make an inventory of questions that you have that are keeping you from the God you love. What are questions that you have that are keeping you from the God you love? And whenever you write that, I would encourage you, don't just immediately let go of them. Because the thing is that, you know, there is nothing wrong. Like, you really, when it comes to your faith, you shouldn't leave questions unexamined. You need to process those. You need to examine them. But examining them is not the same as having them answered. My dad looked at his circumstances from every possible angle, and ultimately he couldn't figure it out. And that was when the practice of letting go came in. He had asked all that he could ask of God. He talked to him about all that he could talk to him about in that question of why, but ultimately he learned to let go. Because otherwise, Seth's death would have defined him forever, and not necessarily in healthy ways. And in light of that, I think it's important for us to recognize when it comes to identity that God will use circumstances and people to show us who we are, but we are not defined by circumstances or people. There is a big difference between God using those circumstances to speak to us, to instruct us. There's a difference between that and between us being defined by the circumstances and the people that we're around. Big difference between those two things. So let's go back to Exodus 2. In the second half of Moses' life, in the second half of Exodus 2, Moses begins to reflect on some pivotal moments in his life. So I want to read Exodus 2, starting in verse 11. It says, one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." And when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. And after he sat down by that well, he again saw someone being mistreated. There were these seven sisters who were shepherdesses, and they had come, and these other shepherds began to mistreat them. And so Moses, he intervenes again, and then goes home with them, and then ends up marrying into the family. And so we have Moses giving us these back-to-back-to-back accounts of him stepping in when people are being mistreated. In the first instance, he killed the man. In the second instance, he's rebuked for his arrogance. And in the third instance, he finds a wife. And as he looks back over his life, he's showing us this, because as he looked back, he recognizes there was evidence all along the way of who God had created him to be. Moses' character was that of a deliverer, even when it wasn't being necessarily welded very well. He had the character of a deliverer in him always, because that is who God created him to be. And Moses could see that, but in that moment, when he's talking about himself as this man who has gone through all of these experiences, how does Moses feel about this series of events? I want you to look at verse 22 with me. This is after he's married Zipporah. And it says, "Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, 'I have become a foreigner in a foreign land.'" You know, Moses was named in light of his circumstances. Moses was an Egyptian name that sounded very similar to the Hebrew word that meant to be drawn out. It wasn't uncommon for people to be named or to name their children about the circumstances they were in. And Moses, he doesn't see his circumstances at this moment as very favorable. From Moses' point of view, he is now permanently separated from what he regards as his homeland, which is Egypt, and separated from his people, which are Israelites. He was a failure as the deliverer of his people, a failure as a citizen of Egypt, unwelcome among either of the nations that he might call his own. He lived as a wanted man and a permanent resident of an obscure place among a foreign people. His character was that as a deliverer, but his circumstances offered him no opportunity to live into that. No opportunity to live into that. And so Moses, by his 40s, identified as a washed-up exile. It's basically what Moses said, "I am." He's like, "I'm going to name my son Washed-Up Exile, because that's how I feel right now. Have fun with that for the rest of your life." But that's how Moses understood what was going on, because he was allowing circumstances and people to define him. He was allowing those circumstances and people to define him. And so you ask the question, was that who Moses really was? No, that's not who Moses was. His analysis of his circumstances, though, led him to the wrong conclusion about who God made him to be, and we have all been there. We have all been there where we look at the circumstances that we are in and we come up with the wrong conclusions as to who God created us to be. And when it comes to that, I think it's important for us to realize, like, we're all going to try on different identities as we go along. We're all going to try on different identities, and some of them we're going to go, "Okay, yeah, this feels right. This feels like I'm being who God created me to be." And others we're going to have to take off and go, "No, that's not who I am," because it doesn't take us closer to this gift of who God has made us to be. It's just a false self. And so when we start wondering, how do we know which identity is really from God, this is where discernment becomes necessary. And I'm not going to say a whole lot about discernment today, because in 2 weeks' time, we're going to take a whole message just to talk about discernment and decision-making. But the thing that I do want to say this morning is, when it comes to discernment, there's two things that are helpful for us as we're trying to figure out what's going on in our life. And it's the idea of consolation and desolation. And consolation is any experience, anything that brings us to a place where we love God, want to serve him, and have a greater faith. That's what consolation is. Desolation, on the other hand, is anything that takes us away from that love for God, that desire to serve him, the faith that we have in him. So that's consolation and desolation. And when we practice discernment, what we're doing is we're looking at the movements of our life and the experiences that we have, and we're trying to determine what's going on. Who's moving us? Is this moving us closer to God, or is this taking us further away from him? We're trying to determine how the circumstances and the people in our life are affecting us. So when our business fails and you feel like a failure, or you don't get the job that you hoped for, and you begin to feel inadequate, or the person you thought you were going to marry breaks up with you and you think you must be unlovable, or your business succeeds and so you begin to feel like all that hard work paid off and now you're gonna have the good life. Or your thesis that you submitted, it just gets rave reviews from your professors and you are certain that you are on the path that God has for you. It is in those moments that you begin to practice discernment. You begin to go, God, show me how you want this to shape me. So pay attention to the movements in your life. Are they taking you towards greater love for God, a greater desire to serve him, a greater faith? Or are they moving you away from that? One of the interesting things about being a female pastor is almost every Christian has an opinion on whether I should do my job or not. And I would say the world is basically split. About half of Christians are like, woman power. We love Rachel because she's like, it's sometimes not fair to Joel because I'll get invited to speak at places because I'm a woman. So there are certain advantages. People literally have said to me, hey, Rachel, we don't want you and Joel both because really we need another woman. Okay, I'll take that. But then you have the other half of the world, the Christian world, who really doesn't think that I should be doing the job that I do. And I have had people say some things to me over the course of my life. I've had people tell me, Rachel, you don't preach, you share. I had somebody once tell me, well, if Joel's given you permission to fill this role, then it's okay. The first year that Joel and I were married, a pastor's wife took me aside and she said, Rachel, your goal in life should be to help Joel get the best paying job that you possibly can so that you can stay home and take care of the kids. Which, hey, if God had invited me to be a stay-at-home mom, I would have been like, right on, sister. I'm all about that. Joel, go find a good paying job. But that's not who God asked me to be. That's not who God asked me to be. And I would be bald-faced lying to you if I didn't say that some of the things that people have said to me related to who God asked me to be, that if I said those things weren't painful at times, that they weren't hurtful for me, because they have absolutely caused me pain. You know, but whenever I think about it, I realize and can recognize now that all of those experiences, as much as they hurt, they weren't moments of desolation. They were actually moments of consolation. Because the reality is that I was wrestling with my own concerns about inadequacy and could I do this job and am I good enough? I mean, at some point in our first 3 to 4 years, Joel and I began to really feel like we needed to swap roles because I ran the cultural center for the first 5 years and he oversaw the faith community. And we began to feel like we needed to switch jobs. And I drug my feet. Joel was all about it, but for me, my fear was, well, if I begin to lead the faith community, will people leave because I'm a woman? Like, will people just be gone and it'll all be all my fault because I'm a woman and I had no choice in that and sorry. But I've realized that those moments were actually moments of consolation because they brought me to a greater love for God and a greater trust in him and a greater faith and a greater desire to serve him. And that as I had to work those things out, I came to a deep and settled confidence and peace in who he's created me to be. Doesn't mean that stuff never hurts anymore, but it's, I know who I am. I know who he's asked me to be. And so when you're considering whether it's desolation or consolation, just remember, consolation doesn't always feel good. And sometimes desolation may feel like you're getting everything you ever wanted. The key is it moving you towards God or away from him? Is it bringing you to a greater peace and understanding of who he created you to be? And what I've come to know is that ultimately, in an ultimate sense, when it comes to identity, God can use circumstances and situations to show us who we are, but only he can help us, really through that process of discernment, only he can show us who we are. Only he can really tell us who we are. During my sabbatical, I spent some time, my mini sabbatical back in October, I spent some time just thinking about this whole question of like, who am I? Who does God want me to be? Because I've always associated my identity with what I do. And so there's been this long process of me trying to separate myself and my identity from what I do into just who has God created me to be. And so in my sabbatical, I had these conversations with God, and I kind of felt like he gave me a list. Like, I'm a pastor, I'm a mother, I'm a storyteller, and that's not what I do, that's who I am. You could put me in any vocation, you could put me in any situation, and I'm going to mother you, and I am going to pastor you, and I am going to tell you stories, because that's who I am. That's just what's going to happen. And so when I was preparing for this message, I was like, oh, I want to remember exactly what that experience was like. So I went back to my journal, and I started reading it, and I realized that God had actually given me four things that I was. And the first one on the list was the one that I had forgotten. And it simply read this, I am yours. I had forgotten the most essential thing, guys. I had forgotten in my list of who I am that I am his. That's who he told me I was first. I am his. I belong to him. And how easily we forget, because it was nice to be told that I was a mother and a pastor and a storyteller, but that I am his part, I am yours, Lord. There was some weight to that, and somehow I just kind of let it go to the back of my mind and forgot that that was part of my list, but that is where things start. That is where our actual understanding of our identity begins. It's why it was first on my list. I am his. And I think we begin to forget that most often when our expectations begin to be disappointed, like what Miyamoto talked about last week. And for Moses, he had this evidence of being a deliverer in his life and of having belonged to God and been drawn out from the very beginning. But he identified as this washed up exile. It was so easy for him to not see who he really was. And so I want us to fast forward a little bit to Exodus 3. Now I want to start reading in verse 1. It says, now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. This is Sinai. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames, a fire from within a bush, and Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. Now Moses was a shepherd. He'd been a shepherd for about 40 years at this point, so he had burned many a bush in his life, and he knew that when you burn a bush, it burns up. And then God comes to him, and he sees this bush burning in the distance, and it just keeps burning. And so God gives Moses this thing that, like, makes him curious and draws him closer to him. And so Moses thought, I'll go see why this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And what we miss is that in ancient Near East, when a name was repeated twice, it was heard as a term of endearment. So when God says to Moses, 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 that is an indicator that God is coming to him as a friend, as someone who wants a relationship with him, who loves him. And Moses says, here I am. And God says, don't come any closer. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And then the Lord said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And then the Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt, and I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. So I have come down to rescue them from the land of the Egyptians. And he goes on to talk about what that will look like. And then in verse 10, he says, so now go. I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be a sign to you. And it goes on. But the thing that's interesting is Moses goes on, and he has all these questions for the Lord. And God says, I'll be with you. And Moses says to God in verse 13, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And so when we read this story, if you keep reading, there's this back and forth between God and Moses. And from our perspective, we're looking at Moses, and it feels like he's reluctant. From the very beginning, we see this reluctance. But in that culture, it would have been expected for Moses to not immediately say yes and to offer all these self-deprecating questions, because if he had just automatically said yes, then he would have been considered a really arrogant man. And so the people who originally read this, they would have been tracking, going, okay, this is what Moses is supposed to do, all the way up through chapter 4. If you'll look at verse 10, it says, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. And the Lord said to him, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, and I will help you speak, and will teach you what to say. And then in verse 13, this is when people would have been stunned, because Moses says next, pardon your servant, Lord. Please send someone else. That is not what the great deliverer is supposed to say. Maybe he would have offered a few more self-deprecating questions, but Moses, he said no. He said no. And it seems like Moses had kind of settled into this sense of just being okay with being the washed up exile. You know, maybe there was a lot of pressure in being the son of a Pharaoh, and he was like, you know what, being a shepherd that nobody really wants anything of, not that bad. I think I could live like this for the rest of my life. But God knew that's not who Moses was. And so God comes to Moses, and he tells him, you are the deliverer. I am sending you. And Moses wasn't going to get off the hook as easily as he wanted to. For those of you who have been around long, you know my path to ministry was a reluctant one. I had other plans for myself. I wanted to go into the judiciary and had my eyes set on great and wonderful things that I thought I could do in that world. But God knew me. I knew what I wanted to do, but God knew me. And the happiness that God desires for each of us far exceeds the happiness we can imagine for ourselves. And the question is can we lean into that? Can we trust that? And I think the way that we learn to do that is through knowing God. It's through knowing God that we get the courage to be who he created us to be. That term that God uses when he says, I've seen the Israelites and I'm concerned for them. The better translation of it in Hebrew is actually, I have seen them and I want to make myself known to them. That's really what this was all about. You know, we forget that between the patriarchs and Moses, there was this period in the history of Israel where they didn't really know who God was. They didn't really know him, and so they didn't know how to relate to him. They mixed their faith with other religions. There was this very pantheistic understanding of God being in all things, and even some pagan aspects became a part of their faith. But when God heard them crying out in their misery and they began to pray, he came and he made himself known to them in a way that they had never known him before. And it was by knowing him that they began to know and understand who they were created to be as the people of God. And for us, it's as we grow to know him that we begin to understand who we are. And I love when Moses asks God the question, who are you? God says, I am. No qualifiers, nothing identifying out there. He is the great I am. And so he can tell you who you are. He can show you what he created you to be. Because this is what I have observed. As a pastor, I've seen people strive for things and just know if they can get that right job, that right spouse, that right education, the right kind of justice, then they'll have the life that they want. And it can all be perfect, but it will never be enough if we are not becoming the people God created us to be. The children of Israel, if you want a spoiler, what comes next, as God leads them out of Egypt, he provides everything for them. And they complain and they moan, and it's not enough, because then they have to wander around in the wilderness for 40 years becoming who God asked them to be. And that sometimes is the process we find ourselves in. But in that 40 years, sometimes we think the problem is God. And Joel, when we were in grad school, he really wanted to go skydiving. And I knew that he would never pay for himself to go skydiving, and so I decided I would pay for him to go skydiving. And when we got there, I began to wonder about my judgment in choosing to go skydiving and allowing my husband to jump from 10,000 feet in Springfield, Missouri. We drive up, and it's like this broken-down barn, and there's kind of like this shed over there, and they take him to this set of like old jumpsuits, and he puts on this bright yellow one, and then we walk out after he signs his life away, and we watch as someone's jumping, and as they're jumping, the diving instructor goes, "Oh, that's cool," and we go, "What?" He goes, "Oh, they just had to do a cutaway," and I didn't know what a cutaway was, so I said, "What's a cutaway?" And he said, "Oh, that's when the parachute doesn't work, and so you have to cut it away and use the second parachute." I was like, "Oh." So if we had kids, I probably would have like pulled Joel aside and been like, "I think we just need to cut our losses and run." But we didn't, so I let him jump. Thankfully, he survived. The fun part of the story is he landed in a cow pasture that was adjacent to where he should have landed and landed in a cow paddy. So he stood up and turned around, and it was just brown all over his yellow suit. He looked like a bruised banana. But I think sometimes we end up in these, we get exactly what we want, and it doesn't look like what we thought it did, and we go, "Okay, God, if that's who you are, then I'm done with you." But God isn't some second-rate skydiving instructor. He is the great I am. He is the great I am. And if we will hang out in relationship with him, we'll get to know that. So this brings me back to the question we started with this morning, is who are you and who does God say that you are? Last year, as I was talking with the Lord about this question in prayer, he gave me this image that I felt like he said, "This is who you are, Rachel." And it was an image of this tree planted by a stream of water. It's from the Psalms, this tree that's planted by the water that won't be moved. And in my journal, this is what I wrote. I said, "I desire the grace to be just so, in order that others might see you more clearly in me as a part of your creation." And guys, that is a far cry from where I started off in this world and what I wanted. I thought the good life was me being this like flashy monument that had achieved all of these great things and was going to be remembered and known for my accomplishments. And I wanted to be the Washington Monument. You know what I mean? Like that's what I wanted. But that's not who I am. God has given me this picture of me being a tree planted by the water, and I think I will spend the rest of my life discovering just what that means. What does it mean? I think God has words and images that he wants to offer you that you get to spend the rest of your life uncovering and understanding and growing into. And there are practices that help us on that journey. We can practice receiving from God. We can practice letting go. We can practice discernment. And when it comes to this last bit of really knowing God, I would encourage you to practice finding him in Christ. Practice finding him in Jesus. Jesus came so that we could see God more clearly, so that we could know him more. So if you're looking for God, start with Christ. Go with Jesus as your guide. And you'll discover some beautiful things about the Lord, which in turn will help you understand more who he's created you to be. So will you guys pray with me this morning? Lord, I thank you that every person in this room, Lord, you knit them together out of all of the possibilities of what could have been created at the time of their conception. You chose them. You chose them, Lord. And Lord, you love each of us in a way that our minds are not big enough to fathom. And Lord, you have plans for us, God. Good plans. Plans that help us to know and love and serve you. And so, Lord, I just ask that you would help us to see you more clearly. And in that process, be able to receive the gift of ourselves from you. Lord, take away our striving and our anxieties and our... God, I don't ask you to take away our struggles, because that's often how we come to know who we are and who you are. But Lord, I pray that in the midst of the struggle, we will know you. And so Lord, would you please bless your people? Lord, would you make your face to shine on them? Would you be gracious to them and give them peace? And I pray this in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And together all God's people say, amen. We love you guys. Joel will be back next week. He will be super excited to see all of your beautiful faces here. So come help us welcome him back.